This is Georgette Kelly, May 10th, 2002, Jung and Buddhism.
To give some talks, and I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just try and pull together for myself and this whole issue of Jung and Buddhism, because it's been my two major kind of paths in my life. So, and sometime over the summer, I came up with this kind of being in emptiness, because it's got a lot of different ways to take it, and I liked it. And the first was scheduled for November 4th or 3rd in New York City. And it was sold out, you know, at the foundation, which is very unusual. There's well over 100 people there. And there was Ground Zero, and they too had had to cancel their first October session. And it was just this incredible energy of everybody trying to kind of come to terms with Ground Zero. And I will talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. But so I've given this also in North Carolina. A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine, I said, I'm working on this lecture. And she said, gee, I hope they understand you. I said, well, I hope they do too. But it's a little dense. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go two-thirds of the way through, and it will lay out a lot of the basic stuff. And then I want to add, you know, just, I don't love to lecture, but I'm going to do it. I love the kind of question and answer. So we'll take a few questions, then we'll take a break, then we'll come back and I'll finish it. The second, the last part has a lot of some clinical examples, and I go into some stuff around Buddhist teachings on the nature of mind and the Jungian self, and then we'll have more questions. So, and that's what I really enjoy, is that. So, recently, while surfing through the Zarathustra seminar, that's what you have to do with Jung. You have to kind of, you know, surf through it. Jung's discussion of Nietzsche's "Thus Spake Zarathustra," I came across some comments from Jung on the East that really capture his ambivalence. The East, this is a quote, "The East is of invaluable importance. During thousands of years, masterminds have worked out those ideas, and we would be foolish not to adopt them, inasmuch as we can thereby clarify our own. They must not be taken instead of our own ideas, but in order to clarify them. If we lose ourselves in the Eastern ideas, of course we become quite vaporous." Just prior to this quote, Jung acknowledged that his understanding of the self was a formula that came from the East. Jung borrowed the concept and name of the self from the Atman of Hindu philosophy. The fact that such a central concept as the Jungian self comes from the East indicates the extent of Jung's indebtedness to the East. Jung is commenting that had Nietzsche understood this concept of the self, he would not have become so inflated. Okay. Notice that just after stating that the East is invaluable, Jung feels he must make the qualification, if we lose ourselves to the East, we run the danger of becoming quite vaporous, which the dictionary defines as like vapor, foggy, misty, fleeting, unsubstantial, fanciful. We might say not enough earth, not enough substance, ungrounded, too much air, flaky, too new agey. If the final goal of Eastern spirituality is to get off the wheel of samsara and achieve nirvana, Jung seems to have a point. The Tibetan goal of achieving rainbow body has even more of the sense of an ascent into air and out of the body. According to Jung, we need to know who we are, but one is also that which one is seeking. The individual's goal characterizes him. One must question, what is one's goal in doing Buddhist practice? And what are the goals of analytic practice, of individuation? Jung's affinity with Buddhism seems to have stemmed from the shared goals of becoming conscious and dealing with human suffering, with the emphasis on experience rather than rational thoughts or ideas. Jung had a discussion with his Zen master, Hisamatsu, which we will discuss a little bit later. At one point in the discussion, Jung proclaims unequivocally The aim of psychotherapy is exactly the same as that of Buddhism. This comment seems exciting in that he could feel such an affinity, and yet strangely naive given our understanding of psychotherapy today. Did Jung really understand Buddhism and meditation practice? This gives some indication of the complexity of our topic, Jung and Buddhism. My intention tonight is to reflect on the extremely fruitful dialogue between Jungian analysis and Buddhist thought, both in theory and in practice. It's a dialogue that is evolving with the increasing involvement of Westerners and reports about meditation experiences. And what I'm going to try to do tonight is to ground in the personal, and I have a few people's example of their experiences. Okay. And also Jungian analysis is evolving away from, you know, and including more things than just the classical approach. So first I want to comment on the considerable influence of Buddhism on the development of Jung's theory. Second, I'm going to reflect on Buddhism in the West. From its earliest introduction into Western culture, it was invited and has evolved through a dialogue with psychotherapy and psychology. But why is it so attractive to Westerners? Perhaps the modern existential experience of emptiness impacts this interest. I would wonder also about the generation of Western Dharma teachers of Jewish background. Why is this? I don't really have an answer for that. Third, I will examine that this issue of the Jungian concept of the self and the Buddhist no-self doctrine, we want to look at those two things. And of course, the very difficult issue of egolessness. It appears that both meditation and analysis strengthen the ego in some significant ways, while both also call into question the assumed self-identities of the individual. And we want to kind of sort that out. Buddhist teachings on the nature of mind do seem to me to offer both a deeper understanding and, most importantly, a direct experience of the self that Jungian analysis might not offer and, in fact, could prevent. Fourth, I will try to contrast aspects of the Jungian individuation process and Buddhist meditation. And one of our underlying themes is emptiness. We want to clarify the psychological state of being or feeling empty, which can be experienced as gaps in the personal ego, or as a fertile void, the generative potentiality that may in fact be the goal of both practices. Another theme is how both systems can encourage an individual to overlook the importance of the interpersonal dimension in favor of the intrapsychic and as an escapist thing. My hypothesis is this. Jung's warning about Westerners using meditation to support their denial and repression seems valid to me. However, one of the misunderstandings might be that Westerners tend to see the Buddha as a schizoid state, in a dissociative rather than facing demons. I do believe that meditation can assist one in encountering the unconscious, and on the other hand, that Jungian analysis might be an indispensable component to one's spiritual path. Okay, Jung's relationship to the East. It began in childhood when he had a fascination with Hindu mythologies, and it continued throughout his life. In the last years of his life, there are several dialogues that are recorded that Jung had about Buddhism. In particular, stating his belief that what he was talking about was the same reality as Buddhism, but with different words. Jung's indisputable role as a pioneer in the East-West dialogue is reflected in the remarkable esoteric texts that came to his hand, into his hands in the 20s and 30s, and also his boldness in offering psychological commentaries on these texts. The list includes The Secret of the Golden Flower, published in 1929. It was a Taoist alchemical text. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, published in 1935, which he said was his constant companion. We'll look at that some more tomorrow in the workshop. The Tibetan Book of Great Liberation, published in 1939, which is a Dzogchen text on the teachings of the nature of mind, which is incredible that this came to him, and then he's commenting on it. And then, of course, we have his psychological commentary on the I Ching, published in 1950. And he states that he began experimenting with the I Ching in 1920. Now, this ancient book, the I Ching, is really the basis of his friendship with Richard Wilhelm. Jung's friendship and comments about Wilhelm explain both how central Eastern thought was to the development of his theory, and this friendship may have been the experience that led to his ambivalent and complex attitude toward Westerners turning to the East. Wilhelm is best known for his translation and commentary on the I Ching, and it is this friendship with Wilhelm that was critical in Jung's fears of Westerners being taken over by the East. So this friendship gave him access to the East, and yet I think also developed some of his fears. There are two sources on this friendship. One is the memoriam that he gave for Wilhelm. It's in that little thin, I think, volume 15 or something. And then there's an appendix in Memories, Dreams, and Reflection that's comments on Wilhelm also. In the memorial for Wilhelm, Jung states that he received more from Wilhelm than any other man. And this is his comments about Freud are just before this in that volume. And it's really quite interesting to think that he said that. His description was, and I quote, that their paths crossed in a comet-like fashion. The spark leapt across and kindled a light that was to become for me one of the most significant events of my life. Jung met Wilhelm in the early 1920s. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he indicated that Wilhelm's wealth of knowledge, I quote, from the Chinese mentality clarified some of the most difficult problems that the European unconscious had posed for him. This was an extremely significant time for Jung to encounter such a strong affirmation of his ideas given the recent break with Freud. Before going more deeply into that friendship, I want to make some general comments about Jung's relationship with Buddhism. And I'm going to be checking to see if you guys are really following me periodically. Okay. I don't want to see this kind of, you know, phase out. Okay, yeah, trying. Prior to this, okay, there were indications of his affinity with the East. One was the fact that he used yoga to ground himself during his own encounter with the unconscious. Now, that's pretty incredible, okay? During that time, he also wrote The Seven Sermons of the Dead. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It was written in one sitting when there were eerie knocks on doors, poltergeist phenomena that were going on, and once it was written, all of this abruptly ended. It's something like a revealed Jungian text from the inner guide, Philemon. In the beginning, it reads like a Buddhist text on emptiness and the void. But then it becomes a statement of the supreme importance of the opposites. Jung had a strong affinity for Buddhism. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he cites Buddhism as providing immense stimulation to his thinking. In particular, he viewed it as a system of self-healing, one that offered a stance to psychic suffering, with the emphasis on disciplining one's inner psychic life, stressing experience, not rationality. And he states in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections that he saw the Buddha as an image of the development of the self, stating that the Buddha is a more complete human being than Christ. Remember his view that Christ was too one-sided and didn't include the shadow and the dark side. Most particularly in Eastern thought, Jung found significant parallels to the analytic process. One was the emphasis on the development and the evolution of consciousness. The other was the use of symbols or archetypes and the transformation of energy. This speaks to his attraction in particular to Tibetan Buddhism over Zen, with the rich imagery and symbolism that's found in the tantric practices of working with deity images. When Jung read in Buddhist texts, all is mind, okay, he translates it into his understanding that all is psyche. Or the Buddha nature is in all beings translates into the God image or the divinity is found in each individual psyche. So he used these things to support his own view and his own understanding. His interest in the East appears to have declined by 1938. On a trip to India that year, he stayed on the boat reading an alchemical text in Latin. Rather than meeting renowned Indian gurus that you and I would have loved to have met at that time. But he seemed afraid of being taken over by the East and an encounter with such gurus. It's as if he's just holding on to himself. His view of the work and his view of Richard Wilhelm offers a comment on this. Jung had two issues with Westerners doing Buddhist practice. One, that meditation might be used to avoid confrontation with oneself, and the other, that a deep intra-psychic conflict might ensue from adopting the East. In the memoriam for Wilhelm, Jung comments, "Wilhelm has bequeathed to us a task whose magnitude we can only surmise at present, but cannot fully comprehend. This task is now bequeathed to us. We're still just glimpsing the magnitude of this confrontation and integration of East and West. We don't know what the impact on our psyche is and our being when we begin to do yoga and meditate. We're just finding that out. He certainly couldn't have foreseen the degree of integration in our culture in the West, the fact that American children might have a Buddhist ritual rather than a bar mitzvah or a christening. In the Wilhelm Memorial, Jung comments, quote, "Christianity has become so debilitated that even Buddhists think it's high time they sent missionaries to Europe." Indeed, it really looks like that's what's happened. The Dalai Lama has not only become a household word, he's known as a world religious figure on the order of the Pope, a spiritual leader of great integrity, the embodiment of compassion, respected and honored, certainly not just by Tibetans. In this eulogy, it's the first time that Jung makes reference to his term synchronicity, of course in talking about the I Ching. And he shares his belief that the West needs to develop the type of thinking that's based on synchronicity, a thinking that's found in the East. Then he quickly moves. Every time he says something positive, you get a flip. Then he quickly moves into his arguments against the West adopting the East. Now, this is in the eulogy that he's talking about this. He acknowledges the spiritual hunger of our time, and then he speaks of the dangers of occultism darkening our minds. And I quote, "Unfortunately, the spiritual beggars of our time are too inclined to accept the alms of the East in bulk and to imitate its ways unthinkingly. What it has taken China thousands of years to build cannot be acquired by theft. If we want to possess it, we must earn the right to it by working on ourselves." Then he allows, "Eastern systems of healing could be a dangerous infection, but it might also be a remedy." The implication being that this is a poison that might cure, but we don't know. In other places, he expresses his fear that it would be a poison that would be used to control and suppress the unconscious, the instinctual side, and avoid that shadow and the dark corners of the unconscious. He felt clearly that it was the intra-psychic conflict within Wilhelm between the East and the West that caused his death. Jung clearly experienced his death as a great personal loss. When he first met him, Jung wrote, "Wilhelm seemed completely Chinese." In Jung's view, his Christian background, originally he went to China as a Christian missionary, had receded but would later have fateful consequences. This is phrasing of Jung's. When Wilhelm returned to teach in Europe, Jung felt that the European spirit pressed in on him with Christian views coming more into the fore. Jung went to hear him lecture, and he states that he found his lectures sounded like conventional sermons. He saw Wilhelm as being unconsciously reassimilated and losing his mission of transmitting the East to the West. And what ensued was this conflict between East and West in Wilhelm's psyche, but on an unconscious level, without him consciously dealing with that conflict. And Jung states he wouldn't allow Jung to help him address it. He states in this eulogy, a spiritual crisis of these dimensions often means death if it takes place in a weakened body. Wilhelm had suffered a reoccurrence of dysentery that he'd contracted 20 years prior in China, which is a very interesting to think about, you know, this. Wilhelm sacrificed the European in himself, and eventually that got him from behind. And you see, I'm testing to see if you're, you know, in Jung's words, a death is demanded of the erstwhile sacrificer. When Wilhelm died, Jung lost the collaborator who had such a profound impact on him. And he ends the memorial with this statement, "Indeed, I feel myself so very enriched by him that it seems to me as if I had received more from him than any other man." I was really startled to reread some of this a few months ago or a month ago when I was working on this, especially his description of Wilhelm's last years and this conflict between East and West in his psyche. Recently, I was given a tape by a Westerner, a Western-born Dzogchen master, and I found I couldn't listen to it. It wasn't just that it sounds like he came from Brooklyn, but it reminded me so much of simplistic sermons. And last week I read a Zen talk by a Western-born teacher, second generation from the Japanese master, and I had the same reaction. The message was, you must remember that all life is suffering, but come from the heart and all will be well. I've been reflecting on Westerners that went to the East in the 70s and 80s and then returned home, having been enlightened and becoming Dharma teachers. When they return to the States, they have to face their dirty laundry. That's another reference, ecstasy and laundry. But anyway, many Westerners who had spent years in Asian monasteries practicing in rarefied conditions have experienced confusion and despair when they return to the Western culture, facing painful difficulties in personal relationships, confronting their shadow issues. In the recent documentary about Ram Dass, I don't know if you've seen it, it's a really wonderful documentary, he speaks of appreciating his stroke for having brought him down to earth and granting him such an experience of humility. A few years ago, I attended a lecture given by two Tibetan Buddhist lamas, and a woman in the audience asked them about how she could learn to handle her anger. The answer to her inquiry was basically this: realize that it's in your mind. Realize that all beings were once your mother, and have compassion. And I felt that these two men who'd grown up in a monastery from a very early age didn't seem to have answers for the Western personality and psyche. And conversely, perhaps because of the psychological issues that are evoked in meditation for Westerners when they're meditating, Western-born Dharma teachers can sound like therapists with an intense mixture of Buddhism and psychology. I'm not being critical about any of this. I'm just trying to be reflective of some of what I'm seeing. In 1980, I attended a workshop at Esalen Institute that was run by Joseph Campbell. And over lunch one day, he shared his experience of being in India with Zimmer, and I was completely startled by what he was saying. He said that he'd felt total frustration with the pace of many aspects of Indian culture, how difficult it was for him as a Westerner to acclimate to India, and how absolutely happy he was when he left. He concluded that the ego that Easterners are dealing with in terms of egolessness has no similarity to the ego that Westerners have to deal with. He said, using Eastern methods to achieve the same spiritual growth in Westerners is like taking a small hammer or a chisel to a large piece of granite. I will end this section on Jung's relationship to the East by referring to a letter that was published in Psychological Perspectives a few years ago. It's not in the collected letters. It offers a very complete statement on Jung's reservation about Westerners turning to the East. One of the fascinating aspects of this letter is the regard that Jung has for the unbroken line of development in Eastern spirituality, where there was, he states, a natural evolution from basically the magical level, this is really my words, to the development of a method for self-improvement. And he views the West as having Roman Christianity being grafted onto a then-suppressed primitive layer. I'm going to quote from this letter. "What is now standing is rotten. In part, we need new foundations. Therefore, we must dig down to the primitive, and only from the conflict between the civilized man and the Germanic barbarian will there come what we need, a new experience of God." Now note that for Jung, the experience of God is based on the conflict of opposites. Always the conflict of opposites. The conscious, the unconscious, the civilized and the primitive. And he mentions then the intense fear of this primary experience. The need to experience this darkness, the abyss, listen to this language, yet the shock and terror when we face our shadow. I think some of that happens when people sit on a meditation cushion. This is a strong statement about the fundamental, terrifying shadow work that's necessary when one is on a spiritual path. Okay, so why are we as Westerners so drawn to Buddhism? First, as Jung repeatedly points out, our religious symbols no longer convey or contain spiritual experience of the noumenosum. In Jung's view, it's this spiritual need that's produced psychology. It's really fascinating now that we're seeing so much interest in spirituality and psychology. This is a quote, that this spiritual need produced the discovery of psychology. Then he states, psyche becomes a factor in its own right when religion no longer contains us. Okay, and this is more from him. Through this skepticism, this loss of religion, one is thrown back on oneself. Energies flow toward their source, and contents of the unconscious then come up. In a Jungian sense, we're looking for a Gnostic experience rather than faith or belief. We're looking for that experience of the numinous. We want to experience psychic energies that can no longer be projected or carried by our religious symbols. How interesting that many of the initial dialogues with Buddhism were initiated by psychology in the West. That the East-West dialogue has been so fundamentally shaped by psychology and psychotherapy. And even recently, psychoanalysts are having conferences on spirituality and psychoanalysis. One of the first encounters on this continent involved psychoanalysts with a few, I noted just as I looked it up again, with a few Jungian speakers at a workshop in 1957 in Cuernavaca, Mexico, with Eric Fromm and D.T. Suzuki on Zen and psychoanalysis. There's a slim book by that title that had Fromm and Suzuki's lectures. I carried it around with me in 1970 when I was backpacking through Europe before I even, it's all frayed, but I carried it all over the place. I wasn't a psychologist and I wasn't even interested in Buddhism, but I was carrying this book around. Buddhism always takes a new shape, whatever, of the culture that it goes into, right? So we see the difference between Zen, we see the difference between that and the Tibetan that has such a Bonpo, the early shamanic tradition. So what's going to happen in this country, and in the West, I think, is that we're going to have a Buddhism that is very influenced and shaped by its encounter with psychology and with the Western psychology. Buddhism is attractive because of its integrity with our modern worldview. There's no issue of faith or belief. Rather, there's the emphasis on experience and self-discovery. There's no godhead, no anthropomorphized father god to believe in. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. What an appropriate path for our postmodern death of God era. With all the pitfalls of inflation when the divinity is experienced within rather than in projection. I want to suggest that it's the personal fragmentation and emptiness that is experienced in our modern era that draws us to Buddhism. A Jewish friend, now a Buddhist, suggested to me that it was impossible for Jews to believe in a loving personal God after World War II. The Holocaust, he said, made such a deity impossible for many of us. In the fall, in this fall of the issue of Tricycle, the American Buddhist magazine, a woman describes her first encounter with Buddhism. She states, "Buddhism held the key to places that scared me." She described her reaction to reading this phrase in a Buddhist book that had been given it. This is a first encounter with Buddhism, and she reads, "Things are empty, transparent, fluid." This is her spontaneous and overwhelming reaction to that. Fat tears began, I quote, "to wet the pages. Soon the book was on the floor. I was rocking and crying with arms wrapped around myself in some instinctive attempt to hold myself together. What I remember most is the fear that my limbs might simply slide away. Then I remembered that I had always known that fear. It started as a childhood game, lying awake in the dark and trying to concentrate on exactly that place where my skin stopped and the air started. I would try it on different parts of my body, but it was never there, this separation. It couldn't be felt. It couldn't be known. And so I began in my child's way to know that the physical me was not distinct from everything in the world. I could not trust myself to know where I ended and the world began, so I entered the adult world of lies, pretending to be a separate entity." This is an excellent description of an original experience that the French psychoanalyst Lacan believes that we all have. According to him, the child experiences states of fragmentation, but then is mirrored by the parents to be a unified person, and thus develops an internal ego ideal image that is of unity, that's totally at odds with the inner state of fragmentation. Some of you are nodding, you're following me. Later I will address differences in Easterner and Westerner's experience of meditation. But here I would say that the collective nature of the cultures in the East make it unlikely that an Easterner would have this reaction to a Buddhist text. I'm not certain that they would experience their separateness as a child in this way, because they're with family in a much more collective way. You think of the Balinese that don't put their child on don't allow their feet to touch the floor for 6 months. I mean, you think of a lot of cultures where that separation isn't going to be experienced in that way. In my view, this woman fell into her own personal small e emptiness, and this gap is a double-edged, painful, terrifying gift or opportunity. It can become one's access way into the unconscious, into psyche, if it's consciously encountered and worked with. And this is what I think depth psychology has to offer. Okay? This moves us into our next topic, self and no self. As the East-West dialogue has developed and deepened over these past two decades, some differentiations are beginning to be made that are extremely important in the area of ego and self states. In psychology, the self psychologists have been working on defining that little s self. And so we can now differentiate the ego function and capacity of the ego from the subjective states that we identify as our sense of self, the who I am, that gives us a sense of identity and stability and continuity over time. And it's this latter thing, this set of identifications, that are the illusions that create the rigid, unchanging sense of self. And that's what's being called into question by Buddhism. The experience of this is called no self. I'm simplifying this, but there is the Jungian parallel of too narrow and rigid an ego that needs to develop that ego-self dialogue. Some years ago, when I was working on my first lecture on this, I was giving a lecture in Denver in 94, I think it was, I received a workshop flyer entitled, "The Ego Must Die." Perhaps it was a 12-step approach to killing off the ego, I don't know. But egolessness, in Eastern terms, has more to do with ontology than psychology, referring to a process of experience rather than a personality construct. In fact, meditation develops the ego function of focusing, bearing witness to oneself, rather than getting rid of it. The analytic process also strengthens the ego. We need to differentiate personal states of feeling empty, what we might call the little e, from the more transcendent big E empty. The personal feeling of being empty may in fact be an intuition and even an opening to the transcendent reality, which Buddhists call emptiness, shunyata, rigpa. And the West might call the bottomless ground of our being. The Tibetans have a very good differentiation. They call it the two truths, we might say two states, the relative and the absolute. Ultimately, the two are one, but relatively, we experience them as different. Our personal relative experience of empty can be an intuition of the absolute nature of emptiness, but often it's too terrifying to work with it alone. On the relative personal level, we may be experiencing gaps in our ego functioning, holes where primitive primordial anxieties can overwhelm us. However, these gaps in our ego are also places where we might encounter the transcendent. Ken Wilber, the transpersonal theorist, speaks of this as breakthroughs of the upper level, he's such a hierarchical thinker, of the upper into the lower. In Jungian terms, we would speak of the encounter between personal and archetypal, or the archetypal core of what might be called the empty complex. Ulanoff suggests that discusses these ego gaps as making it difficult for us to differentiate the little personal void from the vast and all of the transcendent. Psychoanalysts such as Winnicott and Eigen have worked to name and put language on our primitive dissociative states for which we can find no words or images. Winnicott observed that psychotherapy could deal with the neurotic aspects, the functioning parts of a person, and gloss over the deeper faults and deficits in the sense of self. The analyst and the patient can collude in avoiding what Winnicott calls the madness within, Eigen refers to as the psychotic places, and I think the little e emptiness is related to this. These are the places that cause a person to feel dead, empty, unreal, not truly living one's life. Yet the paradox may be that this madness that we dread and defend against is what is most personal to the individual. Fundamentally, this little e empty, the empty core, as some have called it, involves an interpersonal aspect. It's the original lack of nurture or failure in being mirrored and seen. Thus, these states of empty are often reactivated as adults in our most intimate relationships and personal relationships, the interpersonal. And it's for this reason, I'm suggesting, that working in analysis with another person is so critical in healing these gaps. Before I deal with this in more Jungian terms, through Jung's description of the individuation process and encountering the unconscious, I want to cite a courageous confession again from an American Buddhist. I found it in the fall issue of Shambhala, another American Buddhist publication. Her name is Susan Moon. She's an author and an editor. And she describes a profound major depressive episode that she experienced with a breakup of a significant love relationship. And note that it's this dramatic shift in the interpersonal sphere that can push one into these states, invoking what she called old fears and griefs. In her utter aloneness, she felt, quote, "I'm afraid I don't exist. My body's here, but there's nobody in it." In discussing her inability to eat normally, she reflects, "It occurs to me now that I had regressed to the stage before I had teeth." I can go into this later, but in Volume 5, Symbols of Transformation, Jung talks about the need to regress into the pre-womb And then you reach the archetypal. But it's interesting that these little E empty, where they take us, are often into these pockets of preverbal spots. Then she writes this. I'd been a Zen Buddhist practitioner for more than 20 years. I assumed that my meditation practice would steady me, but it didn't help. This is something I want to say. At times, it made things worse. The demons in my mind took advantage of the silence. They weren't real demons, but they didn't care. They tormented me anyway. My Buddhist teachers urged me to keep on sitting zazen. Don't turn away from your suffering, they said. Just watch the painful thoughts arise and watch them pass away. She began to feel like a failure, like she was a bad Zen practitioner. The practice enhanced her self-blame and her self-hatred, feelings that are a fundamental aspect of these primitive ego gaps or holes. She continues, I'm a nobody, I thought. There's nobody here at all. This feeling of no self was supposed to be the point of meditation, and yet I had somehow gotten on the wrong path. Buddhism teaches that we have no fixed self. There's nothing permanent about us. During the depression, I wasn't myself, as we say. I didn't seem to have a self at all, in a way that cruelly mimicked this central point of Buddhist teaching. You'd think that it would be painless to have no self, because without a self, who was there to be in pain, and yet there was unbearable pain. Finally, she found her way to a mental health practitioner, and she got some relief. Another aspect of her journey that's intriguing for us is in our discussion is the fact that as she learned to trust herself, what happened is that she left the stricter, austere Zen pattern and integrated prayer, both Catholic and Buddhist, and constructed her own spiritual practice. It still included Zazen. It isn't that she gave that up. It's that she learned to kind of integrate it. And I think that's kind of fascinating. Her goal now, she reflects, is to understand who I am, if anybody, and how I'm connected to the rest of it. This reminded me of a story of a friend's mother who was in her 60s. Her husband had died, her children grown, and she went to Japan to a monastery to sit Zazen, in a Zen monastery. And after a few months, she had a psychotic break, and he had to go get her. And this happened in like the late 70s, I think, before we were really aware of these possibilities. So, the point is not just the simplistic statement that one has to have an ego to lose it. The paradox seems to be that one has to have a strong enough ego with which to experience the loss of it or the state of egolessness. If one has a particularly porous ego, it seems to be strengthened before one can experience the transcendent, it needs to be strengthened before one can experience the transcendent state of non-duality that the Buddhist concept of egolessness is referring to. Perhaps a more normally porous ego can experience strengthening through meditation process. As Jungians, we know that such a barefaced encounter with the unconscious can blow one to bits. And this is territory that's familiar to Western analytic psychology. While there are significant complementarity between the individuation process and Buddhist meditation, there are two areas of difference that seem very significant to me. One has to do with the role of the ego and the view of the ego. And the second major difference is the role of fantasy and the imagination. Let's look a little bit more closely at Buddhist meditation. Many Westerners look at statues of the Buddha and think, oh, he's without feeling and emotion. And they think, oh, that's the goal. What we might psychologically call a schizoid state. However, the story of the Buddha's enlightenment is clear. He faced demons. And initially, there were no statues of the Buddha, just a wheel, maybe an empty seat or a footprint. His personhood was not the emphasis at all. One is not to pay attention to images, feelings, or experiences on the path of meditation. It's not that they don't come up and that they don't talk about them coming up. They're called nyams in Tibetan. States of bliss along the way are not to be given attention to. Witnessing consciousness merely notes its coming and going. They just allow those little self states to come and then to go. It's said that the Buddha did not want to teach what he found as he emerged from his enlightenment experience, because it was so at odds with sensory experience and our desire for security. Jung also states that security and stability are a blasphemy to the self. Buddhist meditation experience is one of continual flux and change, the radical impermanence of all things. No element or entity is aloof from that state of change. Mind and world, as they say, are dependently co-arising. Meditation involves profound experiences of dissolution and fragmentation that the witnessing consciousness, in being present, learns to withstand. Epstein describes meditation as a process that develops what he calls a synthetic capacity of the ego. In Jungian terms, we might call this a more flexible ego that has developed an ego-self dialogue, an ego that knows that it can easily dissociate and become complex when it's taken over by strong affects. Jung's view of the ego as a complex might add something to this dialogue, as well as Jungian Michael Fordham's notion of the ego's ability to deintegrate, reintegrate, deintegrate. But the Jungian ego is always at the center of consciousness and develops a dialogue with the unconscious, always holds its own in the position in that dialogue. There's always the subject-object dichotomy, the conscious and the unconscious. Fundamental value is placed I go in a little bit more about the kind of split in the ego. Epstein talks about the ego becoming both subject and object, observer and observed. Tibetan Buddhism speaks of a cognizing awareness that's non-dual, not bound to an ego. And in the conclusion toward the end, I'm going to come back to some of this about this cognizing mind and the Jungian concept of the self, but I'll hold that. The Buddha would not answer the question about the existence or non-existence of the self or the Atman, not because he didn't know the answer, but Tibetans say, even the tongue of the Buddha is weak in explaining enlightenment. Our rational dualistic language and logic really cannot convey that experience. There are many ways in which Jung acknowledges and works with states of psychic interwovenness, such as synchronicity and analytic transference. He often spoke of the concept of the participacion mystique, more a sense of merger from the fusion, a kind of magical layer of consciousness. But the main difference is Jung's fundamental belief that there could not be consciousness without an ego. And he just comes back to that again and again. He saw meditation as a dimming of consciousness, as an inertia of the psyche. You see, you have to really wonder if he understood Buddhism. This is a quote of his. Such an egoless mental condition can only be unconscious to us for the simple reason that there would be nobody to witness it. I cannot imagine a conscious mental state that does not relate to a subject, that is, to an ego. Jung equated the entire consciousness of the East to his collective unconscious. But remember that Jung regards the subjective, non-personal unconscious as transconscious, above, beyond, maybe below consciousness, where time and space are relativized. He attributes wisdom to the psyche. Archetypes bring the encounter with this divine illumination, a luminosity to the unconscious complexes, but it doesn't seem to me to really correlate with the cognizing mind of Buddhism as he saw it. Now, Jung's commentaries on these Eastern texts are just often springboards to affirm his theories and hypotheses about psyche. He often psychologizes these Eastern texts. It can make it more understandable from a Western analytic perspective, but it really doesn't seem to me that they're talking about the same thing. And you have to look at what translations he had to rely on. Evans Wentz was translating a Dzogchen text using a Gelupa Lama that wasn't really knowledgeable about Dzogchen teachings. And he was into theosophy and more of a Hindu. So he was translating one mind as an Indian Atman. So of course Jung liked that and thought that that was about the self. So we begin to see why Jung was making some of these correlations that may not quite be exact. There's a published dialogue between this Jung and Hisamatsu, a Zen master. It took place in 1958 at Jung's home. There's several points of difference and seeming misunderstanding. The Zen master asked Jung if his method can fully liberate a person from suffering. At first, Jung's answer is no. And then later in the dialogue, he states, well, it's not inconceivable. Note the double negative. It's not inconceivable that there can be liberation through inner wisdom. Then they tried to talk about the Jungian self and the original self of Buddhism. When Jung states that the self is the whole, so cannot be fully known since it's partially unconscious, the Zen master asked in a very startled way, what? The self cannot be known? And this is really the heart of the difference between these two practices. When Jung strongly asserted that the aim of psychotherapy is exactly the same as that of Buddhism, it's reported that several observers of this conversation were surprised at his comment. Even though they're using similar words, they couldn't find a meeting of minds, but Jung held to his belief. Okay. What about the individuation process and Jungian approach to emptiness? In a letter to Pastor Bernay in 1955, Jung states, the whole course of individuation is dialectical, and the so-called end is the confrontation of the ego with the emptiness of the center. Here the limit, and I'm quoting him, of possible experience is reached, he states. The ego dissolves as reference point of cognition. The goal seems to be anticipated by archetypal symbols, which represent something like a circumambulation of a center. With increasing approximation to the center, there's a corresponding depotentiation of the ego in favor of the influence of the empty center, which is certainly not identical to the archetypes, but is the thing the archetype points to, this empty center. What an interesting phrase that he's using. He states, we can describe emptiness of the center as God. Emptiness in this sense does not mean absence or vacancy, but something unknown, which is endowed with the highest intensity. And later he goes on to referring to it as the self. And then, as he always does, whenever he talks about things like this, he talks about the danger of psychosis. In the individuation process, the ego is brought face to face with an unknown superior power, this is Jung, which is likely to cut the ground from under its feet and blow consciousness to bits. How does one approach this emptiness given the terrors of this confrontation? The Jungian path is one of working with psyche through images that emerge from dreams and fantasy products. Jung called his method of encountering the unconscious active imagination, and interestingly, he first talked about it in the Secret of the Golden Flower commentary, and he calls it the yoga that Westerners should use or could use, which is interesting. Now, his own initial experience he talks about in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections happened in 1913. In the midst of his break with Freud, when his unconscious was so activated. And he describes the process which he came upon in order to seize hold of the fantasies. He states that the image that he frequently used was a steep descent. Then he would find himself at the edge of a cosmic abyss, like a void to the moon or a descent into empty space. We certainly are now reminded of shamanic journeying. In his commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower, Jung offers some interesting reflections on the Eastern attitude toward fantasy. He's been speaking about the process and importance of personifying images from the unconscious, the personification, the need to take the images seriously, the objective reality of psyche. And he acknowledges this difference with Buddhism, where there's a rejection of all fantasy contents. He insists that that rejection is not the same as the wholesale rejection of fantasy in the West. He states, the difference is this, and I quote, "In the East, conceptions and teachings prevail which express the creative fantasy in richest measure. In fact, protection in the East is required against the excess of fantasy. We, on the other hand, look upon fantasy as valueless, subjective daydreaming. The East can reject these fantasies because long ago it extracted their essence and condensed it in profound teachings. But we have never experienced these fantasies, much less extracted their quintessence. Here we have a large portion of experience to catch up with." In this book, he presents mandala drawings of patients, that he calls them European mandalas, illustrating the parallelism between Eastern philosophy and the unconscious process in the West. He loved this finding these mandalas and the drawings, actually, that he had done himself. "Once I heard a Tibetan Lama say that his Western students were bringing him these drawings of their own and that they would call them mandalas. He was totally perplexed, perhaps a bit disdainful, that they would presume to give such importance to their own drawings. It's interesting to note that the mandalas and deity practices of Tibet are often called termas, which means that they were revealed to practicing yogis, often in dreams. And it's said that they were brought by the Dakinis, female wisdom beings, which means that they came through dream or altered states in meditation. Clearly, Jungians would see these yogis as having direct access to the archetypal layer of the objective psyche. Personal drawings of mandalas are a mixture of personal unconscious, conscious production of fantasy, as well as tapping into deeper symbolic and archetypal imagery of the unconscious. But it's depth psychology that brings a way to approach them as personally generated psychologically imagery, not Buddhism. We do not have time to explore the similarity between tantric yoga and Jung's view of working with imagery and the symbolic material and the transformation of psychic energy." There's clearly a direct parallel there. "The tantric practitioner working directly with archetypal deity images through visualization and mantras and mudras, they activate that particular archetypal energy in the body. Jung stressed the role of visual imagination as a process of contacting, transforming psychic energy, but his purpose seems very different. His statement is that that energy is to be brought into one's life for the transformation of the personality in life. Now, there's danger of inflation in both systems. Imaging oneself as a deity can be rather overstimulating to the narcissistically oriented Westerner. Jung's discussion of working with fantasy in Volume 6, and I'm just going to do just a little bit more before we take a little break here. Jung's discussion of working with fantasy in Volume 6 has an even clearer description of working with emptiness imaginally. Now remember, Volume 6 is published in 1922, even before his text on the Secret of the Golden Flower, which was 29. And he's trying to work out his ideas on the flow of psychic energy, psychic libido. We think it's Volume 6 is all about psychological types, but if you look in there, there's some very interesting stuff on the transformation process of psychic energy. Now, he talks about the rejection of fantasy by the Christian church, the reductive approach to fantasy by Freud and Adler, saying that they all reject creative imagination. He's affirming the dynamic creative aspect of fantasy through play and looking for a method to work with the play of the imagination in order to find these hidden treasures in the unconscious. According to Jung, we must suffer a civil war, he states. We might say between our right and our left brain, between the conscious and the unconscious, he's saying, between the superior, the inferior functions, the undifferentiated ones. Then that we keep working with these opposites until we get the third thing, that symbol that's going to mediate and bring new energy and renewal and rebirth. And he states very clearly, one must find a state of emptiness in order for the creative play of fantasy to unfold. He speaks of the need to detach and withdraw libido from all the inner and outer objects to achieve that complete emptiness of content. This is Jung. Which is the original state of unconsciousness with no distinction between subject and object. So here Jung is using empty in two different ways that I'm trying to clarify here, that seems to correlate with this relative and absolute empty, personal archetypal. He names the opposites that are going to confront each other. First, an emptying of consciousness through introversion, which will then encounter the fullness of the unconscious, a void, which we call the unconscious, he states, and out of this comes the symbol-forming activity or creative fantasy. And at this point, he leaves Schiller and all those people that we can barely kind of follow him through, saying that Schiller didn't understand the symbol-creating activity of the unconscious. And where does he go? To the East, immediately. He speaks of the primordial images that emerge through states of introversion that can be compared to tapas, to meditation, and to yoga. And he goes through that. And then he states, but this is too introverted because there's no new adaptions or attitudes toward the object, no new expressions in one's life that emerges. So Jung views India, unlike Schiller, as grasping that this confrontation between the opposites, it's not just an aesthetic problem, like Schiller, but that it's a religious problem of good and evil. Okay. So we could say this, that Jung is in support of meditation approaches that promote active release and integration of unconscious products. His fear is that Westerners will use meditation to control and suppress the unconscious and to force rather than to leave free this unconscious, okay? His goal is to switch off consciousness, giving the unconscious content a chance to develop, and thus the use of active imagination. Now, his view is that for Easterners, the unconscious was in effect depotentiated. Remember? That their unconscious isn't, it's been worked through by their religious symbols and all that. Okay. He states, for Easterners, the unconscious does not contain large portions of the personality. Their rich metaphysics and symbolism express the larger and more important part of the unconscious and in this way reduce its potential. Okay. Some studies of meditators offer some very interesting support for Jung's hypothesis. In one such study, Westerners had a significant increase in primary process material, fantasy, daydreaming, reverie, imagery, spontaneous recall of past memories, derepression of conflictual material, insensitive thinking, emotional ability, we've all had this if we sat on a cushion, dramatic mood swings. And in contrast, this study found that Easterners had initial enlightenment experiences within a shorter period of meditation. The author concludes that for many Westerners, the anatta, no self doctrine, is taken to justify their premature abandonment of essential psychological tasks. It would seem that it would benefit Western meditators to take advantage of the depth psychological approach that has been developed to assist one's encounter with the unconscious. It's important to do the shadow work that's demanded when the ego directly encounters the unconscious. Personal and interpersonal issues must be included in this process. And I'm suggesting that maybe that's the method that will deal best with an ego that's made of granite. Okay, I'm going to stop here. I'm going to take a few questions. I'm going to just break for 10 minutes. Then we'll come back. And what I'm going to do, and that was like two-thirds. I'm going to talk a little bit about clinical material, a process with Anna Lizand of working with the empty state, just walk around that a little bit. And I'm going to do a little bit on toward the ending of this Dzogchen teachings on the nature of mind and the Jungian self, just because I think that it's something that they bring that's really kind of exciting. For me, it's always been very exciting. I don't know if I can convey it to you, but it's been exciting to me. Now, does anybody have a question that they're just wanting to ask? Yes. Mary, for Tibetans to speak their lineage. So I'll give you my two lineages. In the 1978, I attended the first Kala Chakra initiation in the United States, which was given by the Dalai Lama in Madison, Wisconsin. And there's a monastery in New Jersey that's Galupa, and that was very connected to the Dalai Lama. He always came there. And one of my first experiences in 79 or 78, the Lama there was very ill. And the Dalai Lama gave the Poa teachings, which are the teachings on leaving the body at death. And we were in this jammed room. It had to be maybe, I don't know, two-thirds of this size. It was summer heat. Everybody's, you know, just dying. It's all in Tibetan, and is all I remember. All you could kind of understand was the Dalai Lama kept saying, this gesturing out the top of the head, which is the way that Poa, you're supposed to leave out the top of your head. So I had early experiences like that. And then finally in 83, and I was doing visualization of deities. I didn't know quite what I was doing. I met Namkhai Norbu, who's a Dzogchen master in New York. And he was teaching in Italian. He's a Tibetan teacher. Teaching in Italian because he worked with Tucci at the University of Naples and taught there. And what I found was that by going from Italian into English instead of Tibetan, it's like it was already in language that I could understand. So much of before that, it was all Tibetan that I, you know. And he was married, had kids, and, you know, was not in a monastic, you know. And he said, now this is the essence of the teaching, you know, and this is the hierarchical stuff that you don't really need to pay too much attention to. And I was so relieved that I followed him. Lineage is through the Pereira-Whitmont lineage. Christopher Whitmont was my analyst and supervisor until he died in 98. So that's my Jungian lineage. Probably important for all Jungians to state what their lineage is too. Any other questions? And we'll have a copy of it. If you come tomorrow, I'll show it to you. I think I do. But when Jung talks about the psychoid realm, he's referring to something that is kind of preconscious. And I think the psychoid realm, which I feel has a lot to do with the body, is something between conscious and unconscious. And in some of the alchemical stuff where there's talk about a subtle body, I think it's something that maybe, I've never thought of it the way you just said that, but it might be between. Does that make sense? I thought you were going to have something much more. I don't quite know what you mean by retreat. The ego, our ego is so body grounded that when we approach, you know, the ego really comes from the body. I mean, our early experiences of such body grounding of the ego that I think death is terrifying to us, because as we lose the body, it's just terrifying. Oh, that's one thing. What you're saying, I think, is right. She's talking about her mother having, you know, some psychotic episodes that. And that's what I was saying that Wilbur talks about, where I think that there is a breakthrough of transcendent states and in psychotic experiences. Did you see the recent study that showed if people are allowed to go through that 40% or something don't ever need psychotropics? If they're not interfered with by given psychotropic medication, that they actually, you know, it's like what Jungians and John Perry, I mean, you know, it's work that we've known about. So yes. Now, what she just asked is, did she then retreat into the opposites? And I would say yes to that, that the state of non-duality is terrifying to us on some level. If there isn't an ego to work with that, you know, a lot of Zen enlightenment happens when they come off the cushion. You know, and it's the, you know, it's that's interesting to think about, the role of the ego in being able to mediate that experience. I think it's an important issue that we're just all beginning to wonder about these things and struggle with them. Yes?
Bob Thurman, a Buddhist scholar, said that in the Buddha state, there's essentially a double exposure with non-duality and duality.
Mm-hmm.
That's been really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it suggests not going into la la land.
No, it's not la la land.
Being caught in the illusion, but playing a conventional self-harm.
Yeah, that's a neat way to put it.
See,
we have to remember what the Dzogchen teaching is awareness in daily life. There's no difference, really. You know, we use these words of attaining enlightenment, but it's like right here, somehow. Okay, yeah, yes, sir, one more. I don't know if I'm going to answer your question at all, but in Tibetan Buddhism, there is the tantric practices working with deities, and it's called the Sambhogakaya dimension, and the energy that's being worked with has a lot of affective components. The teachings on the nature of mind don't. So it could be that you could look at it as different aspects of teaching, but that's completely me free associating to what you just said.
Okay. The second question. You know, the story about Maria Louise Franz Franz, who visited Jung, I think, when she was in grade school, and then later when they were considering analysis, and I think he threw the I Ching. And it was an older man, younger woman. That was an application of him using the I Ching in his daily life. Are there any other stories you can think of him using Tibetan Buddhism in some way in his practice?
No, I don't. Other than this Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was, he said, a constant companion. So what Jung was doing with that, we'll look at a little bit tomorrow in the workshop, but I think it might be something that he was doing a lot with, but in his own way. Okay, let's... Jung is emphasizing the violent, eruptive aspects of the unconscious. Washburn delineated three different experiences of the inner void, which I think are useful, and I'll talk about it more tomorrow. But one is the violent eruptive. One is the one that I frequently encounter, which is kind of a dead empty. And then a third is the creative, fertile, renewing void, okay? This is a place that people often refer to in analysis as an abyss, a black hole, an empty place. And I just want to acknowledge that while I've been working on this, each time that I pick this lecture up to work on it, it seems like my Anne Lausanne's enter empty places. And Whitmont and Pereira have a little footnote in their dream book where they say that therapists often discover their clients bringing dreams containing images from material they're currently studying. Mm-hmm. They see this as a statement about the potency of the psychic field, the interwovenness and the transference, as well as a strong affirmation of the need for analysts to continue developing and growing themselves. So I just want to acknowledge my analysts, Zans, that have been working so hard on these empty places. You know, one time I was working on the Tibetan image of the Bliss Queen, and I just thought, why? What? How do these archetypal deities really impact Westerners? You know, I was just really struggling with it. And in walked a woman that I'd been working with for 3 or 4 years, and she started trying to talk about this dream. And finally she said that she'd had a dream of fire around her body. And the Bliss Queen is an image that's a very bright, vibrant red color encircled in a ring of flames and fire. So I'm sitting there, you know, this is kind of strange. She said that she seemed to have the dream twice in the same night. So, you know, really trying to work something out. And that the fire was kind of coming out of her body the second time. But she said, but it wasn't burning. And she was having this terrible trouble trying to talk about this. Well, she grew up in World War II in East Germany with a very strict, non-empathic mother. And her difficulty, it turned out, in discussing this dream was the intensely pleasurable feelings that she had in her body during the dream. And this initiated a discussion about her relationship to desire, passion, and joy. I mean, the Bliss Queen was so in the room that it was like, that was unbelievable. Okay. I thought of working with one Anne Lizanne in this lecture because she's recently expressed an interest in Buddhism. And she mentioned maybe that she needs to go to a spiritual path and instead of the analysis. And I kind of wondered to myself about whether it was a bit of a flight, kind of a defense. But I've been very supportive of this curiosity. She doesn't know anything about my interest in Buddhism because I'm rather strong about having a bounded analytic container, the alchemical vase, and I don't share anything of my personal self. Good boundaries in the analytic relationship help contain and possibly evoke work with these empty gaps. We can talk about that more tomorrow. She's recently decided to go to every other week session, seemingly for financial reasons, and she so often has thought about quitting in the 4 years that she's worked with me that I decided it just was very important that I support this and go with it. Even though I've had the feeling that she's avoiding dealing with a deeper empty place, and sometimes she falls into the sadness and hopelessness and empty, but basically she's always very active and energetic. She loves my vacations. She just thinks they're the greatest things in the world. A session that we had a few weeks ago confirmed my decision to speak of her. She came in, I'm going to work just with this one session. She came in saying that while she hates the thought of coming and has thoughts of stopping, on the way she thought that it was really okay and that it was good for her to continue. And I thought to myself, it sounds kind of like a punishment, but I just kept kind of working and trying to receive her feelings. And I was trying to get at exactly what and when she hated the thought of coming. And I'm going to collapse this session. The top layer was that she works for herself and she hates that this is the one appointment in the week that she doesn't have control over making. She bristled from the very beginning of the work about having to fit into my schedule. And the fact that I have a one-week cancellation policy, and you know, it's always these boundary things have always been a very big issue for her. And as she said this, she was gesturing in the air in kind of a cutting motion, you know. And I thought, boy, this is so severe. It had a kind of, you know, sadistic quality. But I'm just holding all of that. So then the next layer was about her hating school. And she hated it until she was old enough to play hooky, and then, you know, she could get out of that rigidity. She had perfect attendance in grade school because her mother didn't allow her to stay home unless the thermometer registered something, you know, at which point I said, well, did you ever make it right? She said, oh, you know, she never thought of that. I thought she'd be trying to get the... Then she started mentioning that she had a set bedtime and a set dinner time as a child. And she went into how absolutely terrified she was at night of going to bed, night terror. And that she's been very careful to make bedtime fun for her own children. And during this whole discussion, she'd periodically be staring into space. And I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "Oh, I'm kind of blurring out." That's her language. She said that she often isn't able to think in particular times, and this kept happening in this session. And it reminded me of one of her early dreams, which I mentioned, and it was a dream about going up on a platform, and it had that kind of dissociative quality to it. And I was thinking of that. And she said, "Oh yeah, I remember that." But she said she didn't want to talk about that. Of course, that came from me. She said, "Do you remember when that baby was crying downstairs that day?" Well, my office is above a medical office, and I said, well, kind of, I remember that. And then she went on and on about this experience in my office, which she didn't really talk about that much because it didn't register that much when it was happening. She said that she's never able to tolerate crying babies and how painful that was for her that day. And then she talked about whenever she hears a crying baby that she has to, you know, go find it, even if she's in a mall. And then she suddenly said, "I can't do this type of work. I can't work in words like this." She's a social worker, by the way. I said to her, "Well," I said, "you know, this really isn't about words, but it seems like you're going up, you know, into your head quite a bit." And I wondered about trusting images and sensations. In the first years of analysis, she'd come in one week and she'd have these incredible, you know, memories and all this feeling and affect. And then the next week she'd come in and say, "I think I made that all up." Okay. So then she went into talking about her general lack of trust, period, and she kept blurring out and dissociating slightly. And finally, I reflected to her that while her conscious anger seemed to be about bedtime, I wondered if her anger was more about scheduled eating and if that had something to do with the scheduled sessions, that she had to come at the scheduled time. And it was the crying baby thing that kind of alerted me to that. And she said, "Yes, my mother fed me by setting an alarm clock." Then she went into not liking her mother's body and feeling rage when she thought of her mother. Now, earlier in this very same session, she said she had no anger at her parents, that she understood that they'd done the best that they could. So now she's into the rage at her mother. But she could only catch a glimpse of it. And I noted her impatience with herself. This anger often goes into self-hate. And she said, well, she wants this process to be over. The sadness was more available than the anger, but she said, "I can barely feel that it's just there, just there." And then that immediately threw her into her empty spot. She could feel the hopelessness, the despair, and then she kept blurring out and kept kind of coming and going. I hope this conveys a little bit of the intensity of the emotion that was in the room, but that she couldn't feel it really. And it was her survival mechanism, that kind of blurring out, that kind of dissociative place. Then she ended the session by speaking of knowing that about babies that give up after a while, but that she must have fought really long and hard. She was thinking of the failure to thrive and, you know, that whole thing. I bring this as an example of a dead, empty place and the defenses against it, which are all around the intensity of sadness, pain, and rage that are gone through in order to approach the empty, the intensity of the emotions. I asked her 2 weeks later I let her go through whatever she wanted to talk about. And toward the end of the session, I was just left a few minutes. I said, "Did you have any," because now I'm seeing her every other week, so it's hard to hold on to things. I said, "Did you have any reaction to that session?" And she said, "Oh, yeah." She said, "On the way home, I had this incredible feeling in my chest." She said, "It was as if I had been crying so hard that I'd hyperventilated." And I said, "Well, did you go back on it at some point? You know, this whole thing of not trusting." I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Oh," she said, "no, I don't think so." And then she said, Well, maybe I did. When I was telling my husband about this session, I said to him, I think I've hit the kinky spots in therapy where you talk about things that you don't have any memory in, you know, but clearly something got evoked in her body, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow, too, like this whole issue of empty and body experiences. The only way to enliven this core empty place is to go through the feelings. And I would emphasize doing so with another person. The analyst becomes what Christopher Whitmont called the mediating object, standing not only with the analysand, but also often between the conscious and the unconscious, providing some of the protection that was not there in childhood, as a gatekeeper, determining how much, how fast can be metabolized by this particular ego without it being blown to bits, repeating the early annihilation experiences. These psychological gaps or empty places are painful opportunities for growth and renewal because they are really our access ways into the unconscious, personal and archetypal. But the problem is that this involves a death, a rebirth cycle. As one approaches the empty places, the intensity of the emotions that have been deadened do come to life. And paradoxically, the ego has to surrender and, as Jung said, suffer a defeat or psychological death. These gaps in part occur from gaps in early parenting and trauma, and the role of the transference is tremendously important in working with them. The terrors of confrontation do demand an other to do the re-experiencing with a mediating object. Some comparison could be made between the role of the guru and the analyst, but we don't have time to go into that. People are often drawn to Buddhism and to Jung because they have a tendency towards seeking an escape from life here on this plane. They seek spirit and maybe trying to step off the wheel of samsara. However, individuation is about work on oneself in this life. Personal relationships mediate the archetypal as much as symbolic images. Individuation, we now know, is a lifelong process, not just second half of life. It begins in the womb and goes into death, maybe beyond. It means becoming fully who we are according to our givens in this particular life with all the gifts, limitations that we have. Individuation is about playing this life's game to the fullest, a la Krishna's advice to Arjuna, get in there and do battle. Buddhism does not honor the meaning and purpose that's found in living one's karma to the fullest in this life. And that is a major difference. One analysand recently said that she would always thought that her goal was to always be in the states of cosmic consciousness that she's experienced since she was in childhood, to be in unity with all around her. Now she's realizing, she said, that there's a state of what she called I am-ness. I thought that was a wonderful phrase, an I am-ness. Being in herself, she said, that's equally important. We've worked together for about 10 years to get her in her I am-ness. And she's extremely porous, but it's been very helpful in her artistic creation and in her profession. But personally, she suffered tremendously from sadomasochistic relationships. She recently had a dream, and I'm not going to go into this, but it was an incredible dream where it was stated at the beginning, these are people that are going to help me understand something that I don't understand. And she put out a question. The question in the dream was all around what she should do with her creativity in her life. And she asked a direct question of these helpers, and the dream completely faded into emptiness and blankness. And she brought her dream ego into focus, thinking of the question she had, and they came back in. So the role of the ego is kind of in working with this. Okay. And then what happened is amazing. It turned out that the male figure sabotaged her creative self-expression, and she ended feeling hopeless and despair in the dream. Okay. It's a whole system of interior sabotage that throws her into hopelessness and empty despair and this schizoid state. She told me that she has a child that's in a cave that's out in space. Now, often people that come to Jungian analysis, I find, have a magical child place that has protected them and makes a great deal of creative possibility. And the struggle to come into life is tremendous with, just like Kalshub talks about defenses against the self, with this kind of sadomasochistic figure there about ready to stomp them out, and so then they retreat again into the magical. Okay. I want to make this point. Both of these analysands that I've talked about demonstrate the significant relationship between the ability to make use of imagination and the development of trust in relationships. The London School of Jungian Analysis has done really important work in this area. Plaut writes, in quote, "The capacity to imagine constructively is closely related to, if not identical with, the capacity to trust." He makes a distinction between fantasy as wish fulfillment, or that magical place, and imagination, where there's an ego capacity to relate to images in a symbolic manner. And this is the place where Jungian analysis needs to develop an ego capacity. And that's part of the process of mirroring that then is capable of encountering the unconscious. And that's where the developmental piece is so important. Because if you don't have that ego development, you can be taken into thin air, vaporous. Okay. There's another case, but I'll save it till tomorrow. It's about a man who hit this kind of black hole place. I want to end with this, which is just a little bit about Dzogchen texts on... No, I'll do this quickly. At the end of Mysterium, Jung does seem to be pointing toward a non-dual state. Okay, this is one place where he really seems to point to non-duality, and it's in his concept of the unus mundus, the term he applies to the third and final stage of the conjunctio. It's at the end of Mysterium, the union of opposites, the union of the conscious and the unconscious. He defines this stage as, I quote, "the relation or identity of the personal with the suprapersonal Atman," this is a quote, "the individual Tao with the universal Tao." He states, "to the Westerner, this seems all too mystical and not of reality, inconceivable." But he states, in quote, "it's our ignorance of the psyche if these experiences appear mystic." According to Jung, there's empirical testimonies. And where does he go? He goes to the East, right? And to Eckhart in the West, okay? And to the mystical traditions of both East and West. It sounds like it's the final goal is the same when you get to that. Von Franz insists that the final goal is the same. But we have to remember the seven sermons of the dead when they stop sounding like a Buddhist text. It's in the affirmation of the opposites, the need to...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.